My name is Keith Beavers. And oh, wait, I just got this new coffee. I don't know if it's like Sumatra or delicious, but. What's going on, wine lovers from the Vine Pair Podcasting Network? This is the Wine 101 Podcast. My name is Keith Beavers, and I am the Tastings Director of Vine Pair. Okay, guys, we had a little bit of a mix-up. It's totally fine. Get ready. How did Burgundy become Burgundy? Well, let's start here. I'm a little bit sad to announce that I will not be interviewing the historian that I've been talking about for the Champagne series because the United States has a thing called Daylight Savings Time. Europe does not, apparently, and that, wine lovers, messed a lot of things up, but that's okay. One day we're going to talk about the things I thought we were going to talk about, but I need to move on. You want to move on. I want to talk about Burgundy. You know, this is the next big one in France, right? There's Bordeaux, there's Champagne, but Burgundy? Like, oh my God, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, though. You know, our obsession with Pinot Noir because of a movie that came out in 2004, and that obsession continued and continued and continued, and now today the continuation of that obsession is more so in the wine lists of the United States than the purchasing of Pinot Noir, you know, in retail, although that is happening. But there is an obsession with Burgundy right now, and it's been going on for a while. And we have to talk about how did this get here? How did we get here? This is going to be fun. Before we get into this awesome series of Burgundy and how it became what it is today, go ahead and get some background if you need it. Whether you're in Spotify or Apple or whatever, just search Wine 101 Burgundy, Wine 101 Pinot Noir, Wine 101 Chardonnay. And those three episodes will really get you nice and ready for this particular series because we're going to go all the way back here. We're not going to go back to like, you know, Earth moving around like in Champagne, but we are going to go back to when Rome was a mere city-state instead of a marbled, templed, crazy metropolis, if you will. Now, when we get into some pretty fun stories about famous wine regions in Italy, we'll talk a lot about what happened around there. But the Rome thing is important for Burgundy because of the people north of the Alps that between 1200 and 800 BC or BCE moved from the Rhine into what is now modern-day France, parts of Belgium, and West Germany. They were called the Gauls. And their eventual obsession with wine from the Mediterranean coast and the peninsula of Italy, the Italian peninsula, would kind of draw wine into their area. Let's talk about that. So between 1200 and 800 BC, while that was happening around 600 BCE or BC, the vine was introduced into Massalia, modern day Marseille, by the Greeks. And this is how the vine made its way into the Etruscan area and the Phoenicians and all this. And this is when that history was happening down there. And while that was happening, up above the Alps, above north of the Alps, the Gaul, I don't want to call it an empire. It sounds more like a territory because the Gaul territory was ruled mostly by chieftains. It was kind of a landlord society. And it's around the 5th century BC, 100 years or so after vines were introduced into the southern France area, that the Gauls begin to trade with the people of the Mediterranean culture. And this right here is a moment where the obsession of wine begins because they start exporting olives, grains, and wine, and they were absolutely obsessed with wine. Also very obsessed with the Mediterranean culture. Archaeological evidence shows that there are sort of accoutrements or trinkets from Roman and Greek dinner parties in the burial sites of Gaul chieftains, which is kind of cool. The thing is, the Gauls have no written history. The history is from archaeological evidence and the Romans' account of the Gauls, which is very interesting as well. And this is actually where we get the word Celt, because the Romans called these people Keltoi, K-E-L-T-O-I, which is believed to be translated as the tall ones. And that was their height was a little bit intimidating to the Romans, which we'll get to in a second. So the Celts of Gaul were a warring people. They were a warring tribes, always trying to gain territory. And now they have their sights on the Mediterranean because of wine primarily, but also olives and grains and all that. So they decide, hey, why don't we just start working our way down into this area and take it over, see what happens. So by the 5th century BC or BCE, the Gauls make it to the Mediterranean coast. They are interacting with these Mediterranean people. So they gradually make their way down into this territory. By the 5th century, they are actually at the Mediterranean coast. But when the 4th century comes around, the Gauls have made their way over the Alps into Milan and towards the Adriatic coast. They're taking over all these areas. They're working their way south. They want to get to Rome. Again, Rome is not the big marbled city we know it as. It's literally a small city-state trying to become that. But it's in the 3rd century, specifically the late 3rd century, 390 BC, the Gauls actually get down to Rome and they conquer Rome. They pillage it. They conquer it. It's ours now. We are going to do this. And this is where the history gets really murky and the fog of war happens. And there's a couple theories on how this all went down. But at some point, the Romans, who at this point didn't have major big armies like we know today, they were a bunch of farmers with some swords and tools that fought off the Gauls, and it didn't work 100%, but they had to retreat at some point. But somewhere around here, either the thought is either they were paid off or somebody came and saved them. Either way, what happened was the Gauls retreated and they went back to their territories. And it saved Rome. Rome would go on to be what Rome became to be. But one thing Rome did not do is forget the Gauls' invasion of their city. Oh, no, no, no. And this began the Gallic Wars, which was Rome basically just saying, look, we got to take all this territory now because we can't have these people doing this stuff. And by the 1st century, literally 51 BC, Rome takes full ownership and conquers all of Gaul. So in the late 3rd century BC, Gaul takes over Rome. And by the 1st century BC, right before we get into the 1st century AD, Julius Caesar is like, this is all mine now. And when the Romans rolled into Gaul, they actually saw vines, or that's what historians believe. They saw vines going all the way down into the Rhone Valley, because the Gallic Wars and the interaction with the Celts and the Romans, or the people of the Mediterranean culture, it went on for quite some time. And vines were actually people were trying to make vines happen. But what's really interesting is there's a mountain range called the Cevennes, and it is on the southeastern part of the Central Massif. And at that time, it was thought down below the Alps, like, there's no way anything can grow over on that side. So when the Romans got to what is now Burgundy and saw vines and going all the way down through to the Rhone Valley, they're like, oh, my, wow, okay, what's going on here? And as the Romans integrated these people into their empire eventually, they continued to grow vines. But there's something very interesting about this, thinking that the Cevennes was the border of viticultural potential. How is it that they didn't think it? They thought it was too cold over on the other side, but it wasn't. And why is that? It also shows that after the 2nd century, the evidence of Italian amphora disappears. And that's very interesting because remember I said earlier, the Gauls or the Celtic people were very good with wood. They were coopers. So it seems that there was a self-sustaining, there are vines there. There's no amphora, you know, wood is perishable. So it seems there must be a domestic wine industry there. So because of the thought of like no vines can grow over these mountains, I did some research and I found the most fascinating thing, climate history research. There are people that actually research the history of climates through soil and all these different things. It's really crazy. I don't understand it, but I understand the results, which gives me an interesting theory as to how Burgundy really got going. Climate history shows that from the 2nd century AD into the early 3rd century in Central Europe, where Burgundy is, in most of France, there was a climate warming period. Wow. Okay. So at that point in time, the Romans were basically, it was called Roman Gaul. Okay. That's what they call the viticulture of Roman Gaul. That's what this study was showing. And based on the research that I've done with Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and trying to figure out the origins of those varieties, you really kind of see something here. If you listen to the Pinot Noir or the Chardonnay episode, maybe even the Burgundy episode, the initial one, I mentioned this emperor, this Roman emperor called Emperor Probus. He was this Croatian guy who became emperor. He was a really, he killed a lot of people, but he did a lot of great things for the Gauls as well because they were foederati, and he introduced the Gouais Blanc grape to them. That's all in these other episodes, but he was doing all that between 276 and 282 AD, a 6-year period. So this is really phenomenal. This is crazy. He introduced the Gouais Blanc grape to this area at a time when the Pinot variety and the Sauvignon variety were already there, during a time in Central Europe, specifically France, that was having a warming period. Vines were growing, they were flourishing because of this. And this is where the event happens, where all these crosses happen, and eventually people find the Chardonnay grape, right? It makes sense. So we have a long way to go for Burgundy here, because it's not even called Burgundy at this point. There's actually a little town called Gibriacum, G-I-B-R-I-A-C-U-M, where they've actually found a small archaeological diggers have found it actually a small ancient vineyard there. That's Gevry Chambertin. It's pretty amazing. And actually the earliest literary evidence of vines in Burgundy comes in AD 312, where there is a panegyric, which is a speech that is given to a leader for purposes. And this was an orator of a little town, begging for help economically for their town to the emperor at the time. I think it was Constantine, saying that the poverty was so bad in their town that the vines were intertwined and overgrown. And in the Oxford Wine Companion, Jedi wine master Jancis Robinson says it takes one lifetime for this to basically happen. So it shows that wine and vines have been here for a long time. And if there's evidence of vines being intertwined for a very long time, that during a warming period of climate, that makes sense that there would be these wild crossings of varieties. And according to Wine Grapes, Jancis Robinson and Hugh Johnson's Wine Grapes book, no fewer than 156 Western European grape varieties make up this huge pedigree of natural crosses, with Sauvignon, Gouais Blanc, and Pinot playing a major role. So it seems like this is, you know, wine regions are defined by their varieties and their soils, and the humans are the one that bring that into existence. But if the vines aren't there before that, what happens? So this is sort of like it sets everything up for two of the most famous varieties on the planet in one of the most famous wine regions in the world. This is the thing. It feels like the Roman Gaul period with the warming and the crossing and all this, this set up Burgundy for the next phase. And it seems to me that the people of Roman Gaul learned how to tend vines. And as they were doing so, all these new crosses were happening. I think it's fascinating stuff. And this research I was reading was interesting because before this research came out, it was thought that vines in Roman Gaul in general happened at a later time. But what it's showing is, and especially in the area of Burgundy, in the Côte d'Or, that it had been happening for a while. It's amazing. And I wanted to bring this up because what happens next in Burgundy begins what we kind of know about Burgundy. We're going to start getting into some names and some people that you understand. But I thought it was really important to start here because when these people finally get here, this is what they see, because the Roman Empire eventually disintegrates. We're just going to fast forward here. And a tribe, a Scandinavian tribe from an island way up there in the Baltic, start making their way down into what is going to be France. And they settle right in the area of Burgundy. And this begins the story of how Burgundy really becomes Burgundy. But if it wasn't for the Gauls and the Romans and their interactivity and this warming period, it wouldn't have gone this way. So it's pretty amazing. Wine history is so cool. And in one country, every famous wine region has its own unique history. It's fascinating stuff. And this is going to be an awesome story. Get ready, because when the Burgundians take hold, things get crazy. Let's talk about this next week. What do you say? Vine Pair Keith is my Insta. Rate and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. It really helps get the word out there. And now for some totally awesome credits. Wine 101 was produced, recorded, and edited by yours truly, Keith Beavers, at the Vine Pair headquarters in New York City. I want to give a big old shout out to co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Mallon for creating Vine Pair. And I mean, big shout out to Danielle Grinberg, the art director of Vine Pair, for creating the most awesome logo for this podcast. Also, Darby Seaside for the theme song. Listen to this. And I want to thank the entire Vine Pair staff for helping me learn something new every day. See you next week.